We are in the midst, as you know, of a series of studies on the historical context of the Bible. We covered the bulk of Old Testament history last year, and now we're working our way toward the New Testament, which of course calls to mind Rome, and so we're dealing with Rome here primarily. Kind of a simple analysis of Roman history would suggest there's three major chapters. There was the chapter of the kings, seven of them, and I was at least developing the modest hypothesis that each of those kings contributed something rather distinctive to the formation of the Roman psyche, and we looked at that a couple of weeks ago. And then last week we looked at the next chapter of Roman history, which is the Roman Republic, and so we spent some time examining the political theory and something of the history of that era from about 509 down to around the year 160 or so, when again we begin to see another transformation to the third chapter of Roman history, which I'm calling Empire, the Imperial Era. And it's hard to say precisely when that occurred. I would say at least one arguable date we could suggest would be the date of the beginning of the Roman Civil War, when Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon, if you know that story, and took on senatorial powers, which were defended by Pompey. We won't quite get to that this morning. I thought we might, but I've retooled a little bit, so we're going to get pretty close to that era, but not quite there. But we are at the point where we're kind of moving into this transitional time now from the Republic of Rome to more the true Empire of Rome, which really takes place in the first century BC. And so I want to at least work to some degree through those events. And to help us think about it, I'd like to refer you back once again to the book of Daniel. Daniel, of all the Old Testament prophetic literature, is the one that really gives us a fairly distinct portrait in apocalyptic terms of the rise and the character of Rome. It may be alluded to in other texts, but it seems that Daniel was the one that was most clear, even though the way he describes these things is, as I say, apocalyptic in character. So highly symbolic, fairly colorful images are used. Nevertheless, if we look through them into what seems to be the object of those descriptions, it looks a lot like Rome. And most commentators down through history have taken that view, and I don't want at this point to be different from most commentators, so I'm going to share that conviction with them. Daniel chapter 7, give me just a second here. Is the second of two discussions in the book of Daniel that probably, well, I would say in Daniel at least, clearly are the most directed toward the topic of Rome or a portrait of Rome. The first of those we looked at when we were first together, our first time together this fall, and that was that great image, you know, in the mind of Nebuchadnezzar that had the four stories to it and the iron legs and the feet of clay mixed with iron seems to portray Rome. The other text that does something of the same thing but gives us a somewhat more graphic description of it would be in Daniel chapter 7. So if you'd like to find your way there, I'd like to at least frame our discussion this morning with this in the back of our minds. This is Daniel now. It's the first year of the reign of King Belshazzar. And you may recall that Belshazzar was ruling in the stead of his father, who was Nabonidus. Nabonidus was off around the year 549 or so in southern Arabia, doing some things that still remain somewhat obscure, and he left the shop in the care of his son Belshazzar. And so Belshazzar is called the king, even though the actual king is his father, but his father is away, so he's left his son serving in that capacity. And so this is going to be about the year 548, probably 547 BC, that this vision comes to Daniel, and we have it recorded here. Daniel chapter 7, beginning at verse 1, the Word of God. In the first year of King Belshazzar of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head as he lay in bed. Then he wrote down the dream. I, Daniel, saw in my vision by night the four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. Then as I watched, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground, and made to stand on 2 feet like a human being, and a human mind was given to it, probably describing Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar. Another beast appeared, a second one, that looked like a bear. It was raised on one side and had 3 tusks in its mouth among its teeth and was told, "Arise, devour many bodies." Probably Persia. After this, as I watched, another appeared like a leopard. The beast had 4 wings of a bird on its back and 4 heads, and dominion was given to it, Greece. And now after this, I saw in the visions by night a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth and was devouring, breaking in pieces, and stamping what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that had preceded it, and it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns when another horn appeared, a little one, coming up among them to make room for it. 3 of the earlier horns were plucked up by the roots. That's important. There were eyes like human eyes in this horn and a mouth speaking arrogantly. As I watched, thrones were set in place. An ancient one, literally the Ancient of Days, took his throne. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, and its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and flowed out from its presence. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 attending him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I watched then because of the noise of the arrogant words that the horn was speaking. And as I watched, the beast was put to death and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. As I watched in the night visions, I saw one like a human being, literally a son of man, coming from the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. To him was given dominion and glory and kingship, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away. His kingship is one that shall never be destroyed. Not a fun text. You don't look, Gayla, like you're very excited about this text. Let's have some enthusiasm here. It is obscure, I'll tell you. A little bit of obscurity, but you kind of get the flavor of it, don't you? And so we want to have this in the back of our minds as we think about this rise of Rome, which is presumably the iron beast that was unlike all of its predecessors and trampled things in pieces. And I'm not going to get too distracted by little details like the 10 horns and another horn that rose up and uprooted 3 of them. I have a hypothesis. I will float it as time permits toward the end of our discussion, but I'm not going to die on that hill. I just want to give you kind of the big picture, and we'll go from there. So anyway, let's have a word of prayer and we'll get underway. Our Father, we're grateful for your mercies. We thank you for your great grace toward us. We thank you for the joy that it is to gather around your word. We know that unless your spirit guides the way, we grope in darkness. So we pray earnestly just now that you would send your spirit among us, that as we speak, as we listen, as we attend to these things that we find here, that we would be guided in such a way that Christ would be honored and his name lifted up. And to that end, we commit these moments together in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. Oops. Last spring, if you were in the class, many of you were, you know we were tracing the history of Israel and its rather tumultuous connections to the kingdom to the north, which was Syria, and the kingdom to the south, which was Egypt. And Israel was in a classic squeeze play, like a ping pong ball being batted back and forth between these two regimes. And that brought us down to a time which was one of the most defining moments of Israel's history as we approach the end of the millennium BC, and that's the Maccabean Revolt. And so we looked at that and kind of at least traced the major outlines of the Maccabean Revolt, and that's when we ran out of time in the spring. We took the summer off, and then what we've been doing in the fall is kind of running back the tape and looking at what's happening with Rome. And Rome, of course, as you know from the last couple of weeks, has been gradually expanding its real estate holdings, more or less moving east. It did take the Iberian Peninsula, Spain on the west, but most of the activity has been eastward. And so now we're coming to a point where these two are going to collide. And we're going to have Rome on the one hand and Israel on the other, more or less this collision course is going to become part of the story that we have before. So there is kind of a method to the madness here as we've been going through some of these details. And today is the day we want to highlight just how it was that the Roman presence in the ancient world came in contact with the Jewish presence and just exactly what that looked like. So that's our game plan for the day. The Maccabean Revolt, as you recall, took place in 168 to 165. I'm not going to go through this again in detail because most of you were either here and it is online. You can go back and review that if you wish to. But in 168, a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes, the most notoriously wicked man from the Jewish point of view of the whole era, was going to take over Egypt, but he was confronted by the Roman presence, which, as we saw last week, was gradually expanding to the east. And so, as the two came to meet, as it were, in Egypt, the Roman senator who was there said to Antiochus, if you try to take Egypt, that will be viewed as a declaration of war on Rome. And Antiochus, though he was a bully, wasn't stupid. And he knew that if he was going to grab that tiger by the tail, the chances were he wouldn't come out the better for it. And so he, humiliated and outraged, embarrassed before his armies, and utterly kind of, you know, just undone by this incident, goes back home. But on his trip back home, he stops in Jerusalem. This is what Freud called displacement. You have a bad experience at work, so you go home and kick the cat, you know. And Antiochus had a bad experience in Egypt, so he went and on his way home kicked Jerusalem. He was going to have somebody to take out his anger on. And so he shows up and he does all kinds of things that almost seem calculated to provoke an outrageous response from the Jewish people. And he was successful. He took a pig into the temple and slaughtered it on the brazen altar. He required the Jewish people to change the name of their God from Yahweh to Zeus. And he otherwise required them to do all sorts of things that would be essentially abominable from their point of view. This is what Daniel called the abomination of desolation. And it was a moment in which the Jewish people, who had been quite disparate in their outlook, galvanized behind one great cause to get rid of these bums. And the guy who really was the kind of triggering personality was a fellow named Judas Maccabeus. He was the third son of a priest whose name was Mattathias. And Judas was a guerrilla warrior, and he was brilliant in his tactics. And even though he was greatly outnumbered by these Syrian forces, was nevertheless able to turn Israel of that era into our Vietnam. It was just awful, you know. And no matter how much money they poured into the project, they couldn't get rid of this Judas Maccabeus and his guerrilla warriors that just kept giving them grief until finally in 165, Judas is able to successfully retake the temple. It had been desecrated in 168. For that reason, it was not ceremonially possible to continue offering sacrifices. But in 165, Judas is able to drive out these foreign forces, retake the temple, and about Christmas time of 165, he rededicates the temple. And that came to be called in Jewish history the Feast of Rededication, or the Feast of Dedication, actually. It's referred to in the New Testament, Gospel of John, chapter 10. Jesus is said to be in Jerusalem during the Feast of Dedication. That was the event that was being celebrated. It's also called Hanukkah. Hanukkah is literally Feast of Lights, because the theory was, or the legend was, that because there was not sufficient consecrated oil at that moment, they went ahead and did the ceremony in the hopes that God would miraculously supply the oil necessary to keep the lights lit. And in fact, God did that for about 8 days, and thus the Jewish people from that point on celebrated the Feast of Lights, the idea that this oil was supplied. And I'm not going to argue with the legend. I think it may very well have happened just as reported. But one way or another, the battle went on. Judas was actually killed in battle in 161. But by then, Syria itself was torn apart in a civil conflict, so that in some ways it paralyzed the Syrian attempt to continue taking a dominant role in the life of the Israelites. With the death of Judas, his son, or his younger brother, rather, Jonathan took over. Jonathan was an astute diplomat, and he was able, by sort of very sophisticated manipulation of the politics of the time, land on all fours there, and after about another 15 years or so, he was able to negotiate the full independence of Israel. And so when we come down to the year 140, the date of Jonathan's death, he has just been able to establish Jewish independence. This is quite important. For the century or so, roughly from about 140 down to 63, so a little less than a century, Israel was an independent state. That was the first time in centuries that Israel had actually been independent. And so the recent history of the Jewish people at the time of the birth of Christ was they still remembered. It was still within the memory of some of the very old folks there that they had been independent not that many years ago. And they still cherished a dream of reasserting their independence, even though at that time, of course, Rome was present and making its presence rather conspicuous. So in 140, we have the death of Jonathan. This is the next guy that comes along. His name is Simon Hasmonean. Simon is the second son of Mattathias, so he would have been the older brother of Judas Maccabeus. He is a person probably of somewhat less integrity, at least religiously speaking, than the other members of the family. And so he, even though he now takes this position of rule, does some things that are quite controversial and really begins to shift the direction of the Jewish people once again into some sort of characteristics that may not be all that acceptable from the point of view of classical Jewish thought. He was the second son, as I say. The first thing he did, which was highly controversial, was he combined in himself the position of king and priest. I think you know that in ancient Jewish understanding, there was what we might call a separation of church and state. And that was part of the Jewish law. The king could not be the priest, and the priest could not be the king. They had two different institutions. They had the religious institution, the political institution, and it was forbidden that any one person could share both authorities. This is what distinguished Israel from many of the contemporary ancient Near Eastern civilizations, where it was commonplace to combine the king and the priest into one person. It's a way of unifying authority, but to prevent that sort of autocracy from developing, it was forbidden that that should take place. The one guy in Jewish history that really flagrantly violated that rule and paid dearly for it was a Jewish king whose name was? Anybody know? What was the name of the Jewish king who, though he was a pretty good king, went into the temple to offer incense and he was struck with leprosy and spent the rest of his days in isolation, and his name was? Uzziah. And that's back in 2 Chronicles. So the most of the Jewish political authorities took that seriously. They didn't want to wind up with a Uzziah kind of experience. But along comes Simon, and he does it. Simon unites these two because in some ways he wanted to be able to assert that kind of authority. And of course, in so doing, he's asserting himself more or less as a messianic character. The Old Testament had contemplated that eventually an office holder in Jewish history would come along who would combine the two offices. So Psalm 110, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. That's kingly language. Then the same psalm says, a few verses later, addressing the same person, the Lord has sworn and will not repent, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. King priest. Psalm 110 is the most frequently quoted psalm in the New Testament. It's viewed as definitive for understanding the nature of the Messiah. He is the king priest. We call him prophet, priest, and king, you see. But until Messiah comes, no one was permitted to combine those offices. That's what Simon tried to do. And he's been criticized for that, not only from a Christian perspective, but from a Jewish perspective. But at the time, he was trying to consolidate his own power. He did obtain Rome's official diplomatic recognition. So Rome, which is now kind of in his backyard, by the mid-second century BC, Rome is in the region, you know. But he does obtain from them, through this negotiating process, recognition of his independent existence on the condition that he would never provoke a fight with Rome. He didn't have to pay tribute. It wasn't like becoming subservient to Rome. But in a treaty relationship, he does negotiate an understanding that he's never going to go to war against Rome. And Rome, for its part, is going to recognize the independent state of Israel. That was probably his most positive contribution. He also secured Israel's borders. So for the first time, we begin to have an independent state of Israel that looks a little bit like this. If you can see that map, on the right hand of the map, on the east of Jordan, is a region called Perea, which is mentioned in the New Testament. You also have Jericho, the first city there, Jerusalem, and it's all called Judah or Judea. Fairly small region, but it's going to grow over the next several years. Those two little purple parts are parts that Simon was able to add. So the Jewish footprint at this point looks something like that. And he's able to define those borders. And so Israel is now in 140 a state, and that's what it looks like. He did, however, ironically introduce a heavy Hellenistic influence. This is ironic because, of course, his younger brother Judas had been viciously trying to resist that Hellenistic influence. That was what provoked the controversy, the Maccabean revolt in the first place. And yet now, 20 years later, this older brother is actually, to make himself more or less acceptable to the broader cosmopolitan community, is really introducing a lot of that Hellenism. Nothing as egregious as what Antiochus had required, but nevertheless, a lot of the cultural influences and paganism of Hellenism is beginning to seep in through the back door, as it were, in Israel. Well, Simon, he was a controversial character in his own day. He was assassinated by his son-in-law, actually a character by the name of Ptolemy, not connected to Egypt that we know. And that was, he was, by the way, the governor of the city of Jericho. And he comes over for dinner one night and slips a knife in Simon's back, and that's the end of Simon. And that brings the next character, whose name is John Hyrcanus, probably the most important ruler in, well, certainly the most important ruler in Israel in the last part of the second century BC. Fairly well-known character, even outside of our interest here. He was quite successful, first of all, in expanding the borders of Israel. So you can see he more than triples the size of Israel in his reign, and really that's the main thing that he accomplishes. His expansion, first of all, went south into a region called Idumea. This is one of the most important and kind of notorious moments of Israel's history during this era. He takes a fairly strong military force into Idumea and forces them, really occupies or annexes that whole region, and establishes there a Jewish presence and makes it part of the Jewish state. Idumea is the New Testament word that refers to the Old Testament region known as... No, not quite, but you're close. Say me? Edom. Edom. Edom is, of course, a nickname for an Old Testament character, and that character's name was? That's right, Esau. And Esau was the brother of Jacob. You doing well? Okay. Jacob and Esau. And Esau was sort of ruddy. And so he got the nickname early on of being Edom, the word for red. And he, of course, reconciled eventually with his brother Jacob. But the two peoples, their successors, didn't get on so well. And so we have plenty of evidence in the Old Testament of a violent conflict going on between Edom to the south and Israel to the north. And at times they were at war with each other, and there was never really a time of a friendly connection between them. Well, John Hyrcanus decides he's going to settle this conflict once and for all. And so with overwhelming force, he goes into Idumea and sets up a kind of garrisoned presence there and forces the conversion to the Jewish faith of these Idumean people. Now, just between you and me, that never sells very well, you know. When you are forced to adopt a new religion, more or less at the point of a sword, it's not generally a sincerely heartfelt embracing of this new outlook. You know what I'm saying? And the Idumeans, while the choice they had was to convert to the Jewish religion, or that they would have to leave their homeland and go somewhere else. And so most of them did convert, at least at a superficial level. But it bred in Idumea a seething resentment. This kind of superficial conversion was a thin veneer for a deep hostility toward the Jewish faith that persisted for a long time. They never forgot this. And it's no accident that the most famous bad guy in the New Testament was an Idumean. His name is Herod. Herod, of course, was an heir of that kind of quasi-Jewish faith, and he was always, in a sense, caught in this sort of complicated understanding of what was he really. He wanted to hold himself out as a Jewish person. He built the temple, he did all kinds of good things, but in his heart, he was much more pagan than Jewish. And in some ways, people have thought it all started back with this rather misguided strategy on the part of John Hyrcanus. So anyway, he forces the conversion of the Idumeans. He also went north into a region known as Samaria and basically did the same thing. You know that Samaria had once been the homeland of the 10 northern tribes. They were deported by the Assyrians in 722, and the Assyrians brought back into that region then a mixed population, and it became a kind of hybrid population, both religiously and ethnically, and thus the Samaritans were always viewed from the Jewish point of view as, at best, kind of a second-class part of the nation of Israel, and there was a fair amount of hostility there. Well, John Hyrcanus decided he was going to fix that problem also, and so he launches a foray into Samaria. He destroys the Samaritan centers of worship and kind of does the same thing there that had happened down in Idumea and has a lot of the same effects. So you know that from the New Testament point of view, you do have this rather distinct hostility between the Samaritans on the one hand and the Jewish people on the other. The dislike was mutual. The Samaritans didn't like the people in Judah, and the Judites didn't like the people in Samaria. So we find evidence of that in the New Testament. There's one story where Jesus in the Gospel of Luke wants to go to Jerusalem from Galilee, which is further north yet, and a bunch of Samaritans came out and prevented him from going through their land when they learned he was going to Jerusalem. So the standard approach was to go to the east and come down the eastern side of the Jordan to make that trip rather than to travel through Samaria. That was just part of the standards of the day. John Hyrcanus may be responsible for, at least to some degree, that hostility. When he died in the year 104, authority was once again divided between the king and the priest, only temporarily. The successor was a man, a son to John Hyrcanus, named Aristobulus. He only rules for one year, he is also responsible for adding a little more real estate to Israel's holdings. And that includes then the region that we call Galilee. So, of course, that's well known in the New Testament. Galilee was always viewed from the central power centers of Israel as kind of way off there, the hinterland, you know. And to add it now back at this time didn't really change that opinion very much. Galilee in the Old Testament in Isaiah is called Galilee of the Gentiles. It's so far out there, it's almost viewed as Gentile land. The fact that the hostile buffer state between Galilee and Judah is Samaria made it seem even more distant. And so Galilee is added, but it's always in this stand, it's kind of a status of being just marginally respected or accepted as a truly legitimate part of the Jewish world. You know that Nathanael, when he was told that he was about to meet the Messiah, who was from Nazareth of Galilee, remarks somewhat cynically, what? Can anything good come out of Galilee? Come on, you know. It's like saying, you know, that the great world leader, the guy that's going to change everything, and here he is, he's from Washtukna, you know, kind of thing. And, well, Washtukna is a great place. I don't want you to get me wrong, but it's sort of like, wait a minute, this guy should be coming from some more respectable venue, you know, and from their point of view, you know, Washtukna would be miles ahead of Galilee and Nazareth. And so that was, he was reflecting a pretty common view of the day. So anyway, Simon or Aristobulus adds that region. He is vicious toward the Pharisees. I haven't talked much about them, but just to kind of bring us up to date, you may recall from studies last year that in the run-up to the Maccabean revolt, there were two parties in Israel, the so-called Tobiads and Onaiads. The Onaiads were more conservative, the Tobiads were more liberal, and they were in something of a political hostile relationship. This really gelled during the days of John Hyrcanus, and we begin to have the actual reference to these two parties, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Sadducees took their name from the Hebrew word zedek, which means righteous, and so they called themselves literally the righteous ones. The Pharisees took their name from the Greek word aphorizomai, which means separated, and so they called themselves the separated ones. And these two were pretty much at this point well-defined in their hostility. The Pharisees were courageous and virtuous people at this time. We, of course, think of the Pharisees from the New Testament point of view as the most notorious characters, as the people that Jesus beat up on, and so on, and they probably richly deserved it by then. But back in these days, they were the people who were hanging on to the true standards of classical Jewish religion. And they sometimes paid for that with their lives. There were many Pharisee martyrs. And the Pharisees were proud of that heritage, and that's part of what fed into the ego that we encounter in the New Testament. At this time, the Pharisees were those who really were trying courageously to maintain, in the face of the eroding, kind of permeating Hellenism, paganism that was coming in, they were trying to hang on to their true Jewish roots. And Aristobulus, at least for his part, was vicious in attacking them, and in fact, a fair amount of blood was shed under his watch. He was also vicious, however, to try to secure his own rule. He attacked his own family. He was wiping out any other claimants to the throne. As it turns out, however, he only made it 1 year. He died of a painful, dreadful disease, which we don't know. He may have been poisoned, but we're not sure exactly what happened, but he died fairly early on. And that brings the next major ruler of this time, a guy named Alexander Janneus. Now, I know, you may or may not be interested in this. You look interested, and I do appreciate that, believe me, you know. But have you ever kind of wondered, I wonder what was going on in Israel right before the events of the New Testament? This is what was going on, you know. And so I think sometimes, at least once a lifetime, we should be exposed to a little bit of this history, just so we appreciate. This was the recent history of these people. And I think it helps us to realize how tumultuous it was and how much the battles had already been kind of fought along the way that create the sense of what was going on even in the New Testament. Alexander Janneus is truly another of the kind of bad guys of this era. There were very few good guys, to be honest. He was the brother to John Hyrcanus. He may have been the assassin of Aristobulus. We don't know. It would have been his nephew. He was the husband to the widow of John Hyrcanus. When John Hyrcanus died, this guy, Alexander, married his widow, may have bumped off Aristobulus. We don't know that for sure. It's a hypothesis. But in any event, he's the one then that takes rule in Israel for the first several years, then for several decades of the first century BC. He also expands Israel's borders a little bit more. So beginning with what we already had, he adds the purple section up there to the northeast. It's called Iturea. It's to the north of Perea. Both of those regions are mentioned in the New Testament. He also adds a little bit of terrain there toward the south. He is harsh, bitterly harsh, violently harsh toward the Pharisees. And there are multiple examples where he launched a kind of purge trying to get rid of these people. And on many occasions, they stood up courageously and heroically, paying with their own blood for this attack upon them. So again, the Pharisees are kind of the good guys at this time. And I think that's important for us to appreciate. But in any event, he dies in 76, and that brings the last of the rulers of independent Israel to the throne in 76. This man's name is John Hyrcanus II. By the way, Hyrcanus is a reference to a region, Hyrcania, and so it seems just that it's identifying these people with their roots in terms of what they where they came from, up to the north toward Turkey. John Hyrcanus is the son of Alexander Janaeus. He takes the principal position of rule in Israel in 76, but only as its priest. His mother, the wife of Alexander Janaeus, retains the regency. So she, in a sense, is the queen, if you will, while John Hyrcanus serves as the priest. So you have a division of that authority. But certain things happen during his reign that really do set us up for the coming of Rome. As I say, he was first of all the high priest. In 67, on his mother's death, he does take the rule, the political authority in Israel. His mother's name was Salome. But the very same year, 67, his younger brother, Aristobulus II, attacks him and successfully drives him out. So this guy, John Hyrcanus, is now out of town on the lam. Hyrcanus goes down to a region called Nabatea, which is to the south. It's where the city of Pella is located, if you've traveled in that area. And he hires a mercenary army to come back and help him drive out this usurping brother of his. And so in 64, he puts Jerusalem under siege. Pompey is up in Turkey at this very moment, fighting battles with a king called Mitridates, successfully defeating him and continuing to expand Roman presence then across Turkey. And now Pompey comes down south to the eastern side of the Mediterranean into Syria. And of course, that puts him right on the back doorstep of Israel. Rome is already in Egypt to the south. Rome is now present in Syria to the north, and when Pompey shows up at Jerusalem, he finds Jerusalem under siege. As John Hyrcanus is attempting to drive out this brother of his who has taken possession of the city. So Pompey sits down, has a Starbucks coffee with John Hyrcanus II, and says, "Okay, pal, if you work with me, I'll work with you. You want to retake Jerusalem, that's fine. But here's the stipulation. Rome will help you do this, but only on the condition that you are not reinstated as king. We'll put you back as high priest, and we'll make you the chief guy in town. But you need to swear fealty to Rome, and you need to enter into a tributary relationship with Rome, and Rome will essentially become the overseeing authority of Israel." And John Hyrcanus and Pompey have this conversation, And John, of course, is in no great position to try to negotiate different terms, and so he agrees. In 63 BC, Pompey launches an all-out effort against this city of Jerusalem and breaks through and indeed occupies the city at that time. Now, Pompey, of course, is a Roman general, and one of the things he's always looking for is money. One of the most famous incidents of Jewish history, according to Josephus, is that Pompey, once he's in town, immediately goes to the temple, assuming that within the inner sanctum of the temple, what we call the Holy of Holies, he would find, you know, all kinds of treasures, gold bricks. That's where people usually stored their treasuries, and he was going to loot the temple. That was his plan. He goes to the temple. He doesn't realize he's not supposed to walk into the inner sanctum, so he walks right in. He is Pompey, after all. What does he find in the inner sanctuary? Anybody know? Nada. No, it's an empty room. Not even the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was somewhere else where Indiana Jones would discover it many years later. But the room was empty. We don't know exactly when the Ark of the Covenant disappeared, but it was probably before the Babylonian attack in 586. In any event, the room was empty. Pompey was somewhat disappointed, but nevertheless, true to his word, he did put John Hyrcanus into the priestly position. But from that point, from 63 on now, Israel is an occupied region. I'd like to just quickly, very quickly, kind of trace what was happening in Rome at this point. Rome, in about the time of the Maccabean Revolt, has occupied real estate up to the Black Line there, everything west, including Spain, Italy, Greece, most of Turkey, Egypt, and now, of course, closing in on Palestine, is under Roman control. The transformation of Rome took place through a series of rather important leaders, all of them military in character. It begins with a couple of guys who were both tribunes. They were brothers. The name was Gracchi. They attempted to bring about land reform. If I can just say this in 30 seconds, Rome now is so far afield that it's straining its republican system of governance. The Roman soldiers had always traditionally been landholders and farmers, and they would fight defensive wars, kind of like a militia, and then go back to their land. But the further afield the army goes, the more strain it puts on these guys, and many of them had to go deep into debt just to go fight Rome's wars, and then they got foreclosed on. So by the time we reach this era, Roman farms were not owned by gentlemen farmer soldiers anymore, but by great mega corporations, kind of like American farming today, you know, where huge companies were holding all these farms, and the people who had once been the farmers are now out of work, and in many cases bankrupt, and in a very unhappy situation. The whole problem was highlighted by these two, the Gracchi. They both were assassinated, but they did put the issue on the table in a dramatic way, and that set things up for the first of these kind of transforming military commanders, a guy named Gaius Marius. And he's the one who, for the first time, makes the Roman soldier a man more attached to his commander than attached to the city of Rome or to the farm. That's an incredibly important moment. And it was a great kind of re-engineering of the Roman understanding of the nature of the military. Now the military belongs to the man. And Gaius Marius was the first one to really develop that philosophy of military. The next one is a character, you've probably heard of these names, a guy named Cornelius Sulla. He takes it a step further and puts pressure on the Senate, which made a decision he didn't like very much, by actually marching on Rome. So he takes his army, which is a Roman army, and actually attacks his mother city to put pressure on the Senate to give him what he wants. That's a great paradigm shift. It was unthinkable for the Roman army to attack Rome. You see, that wasn't supposed to happen, but Sulla changes the rules, so it's another step into imperial Rome, militaristic Rome, iron Rome, rather than republican Rome. The next guy that comes along is Pompey, and Pompey is the one who then sort of takes this imperial state of mind and goes out into the world to transform it into a Roman imperial kind of structure rather than a Roman republican structure. And it was doing that very thing that brought Pompey into Israel and into this negotiation with John Hyrcanus II. The last of these guys who we'll leave for a further later discussion is Julius Caesar, who indeed goes to war with Pompey. And in that civil war, of course, Julius Caesar wins. And we would say, I think most historians would say, that's when the real transformation happened, that Rome became a militaristic and imperial kind of structure rather than a republican sort of operation that it had been earlier. Okay, sorry I had to rush through that, but let's go back very briefly to Daniel. And with that kind of idea of military Rome in mind, I think Daniel is describing the picture of Rome that would be the way you would see it if you were a Jewish person living at this time. It does look like an iron beast. It does look like it's breaking in pieces, devouring, trampling. You see, that would be, from the Jewish point of view, exactly what this Roman world looks like. And of course, this whole description has to be understood from a Jewish point of view. That's the whole purpose of it. Who is this little horn? Well, first of all, who are the 10 horns? I don't know. So let's get that on the list first. But I have a hypothesis. It is interesting to me that if you start from Julius Caesar and count the number of Caesars to the fall of Rome, so that start with Julius Caesar and end with Vespasian, who was ruling Rome at the time Jerusalem collapses, and it's the end of the Jewish world, there's precisely 10 Caesars. So maybe that's it. I don't know. I'm not teaching that as a doctrine of the church. I'm just giving a hypothesis. From the Jewish point of view, who is this little horn that pops up and uproots three of them? I don't know. But I have a hypothesis. Again, from a Jewish point of view, the Roman rule would appear to have been eclipsed by those, that family that became the face of Rome to the Jewish people, the Herods. And Herod certainly fits the description that is suggested here. Now, I'm on a skinny branch, and I want you to realize that. I'm just floating trial balloons, but, you know, when you try to understand what's going on, that's at least a possible way of viewing it. It's not my private invention. I've read that in some commentators, and there's a lot of discussion, but at least that's a possibility. What's of greater interest to us is what happens next. There is this Ancient of Days, clearly from Trinitarian perspective, God the Father. He's described in these powerful terms. He's the one who's really ruling. And you have a time of great judgment, you see. This is one of the things that breathes in the New Testament, is that whatever else is going on, it is a time of judgment. It's a time of judging the old order and bringing in the new. And you find that again and again, that idea that this is John the Baptist, of course, is bringing a great message of judgment, you know, so on. So it's part of the message. And this moment of judgment is happening. We have a great pronouncement of judgment against the beast, even though the appearance of the beast will last for a while. It'll be a couple of hundred years before Constantine, representing the whole Roman world, will bow the knee to Christ. Quite a dramatic moment, but in apocalyptic terms, we can allow for that kind of expansive view of what's going on. But then this final section that I want you to notice, as I watched the night, I saw one like the phrase here is a son of man. This is one of the most famous texts in the New Testament era describing a character who would come called the Son of Man. And it is very intriguing that that was Jesus' favorite term for himself. Of the 83 times that that phrase is used in the New Testament, 81 of them are from the lips of Jesus. It is by far his most favorite personal designation, the Son of Man. And many have wondered, you know, why is Jesus using that? And at least I think one quite plausible hypothesis is he's calling to mind this text in Daniel, where the Son of Man is a great judge character, you see. And so he comes, and he's the one who has a kingdom presented to him by God. To him was given, verse 14, dominion and glory and kingship. that all peoples, nations, languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away. His kingship is one that shall never be destroyed. So when Jesus says to his disciples, all authority is given unto me, and he ascends and tells them to go and make disciples of the nations, he's doing exactly what we would expect the Son of Man to do if he's playing out what was predicted by Daniel in this chapter. My own view is that's exactly what's going on. Whatever we do with some of the details, the big picture seems to stand for that proposition. My Sunday school lesson for you this morning is this. Romans 12, 1 and 2. I beg you, by the mercies of God, present yourself to God as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, because it is your only, the Greek word there is logikein, we have the word logic, it's your only rational service. If this one who is the Son of Man, if this one who is the King of the universe and is competent to run the entire cosmos is the one that we believe he is, Jesus of Nazareth, then he is also competent to run your universe. And there is nothing more irrational than resisting his authority. So I beg you, and I beg myself, surrender absolutely to him. He is much better at guiding your life than you are, you see. And to the degree that we hold out, to the degree that we're qualified in giving Christ absolute sovereign authority to dispose of our lives as he wishes, without any reservation, qualification, strings attached, to the degree that we do something less than that, we are insane and we are idolaters. If Christ is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, as we say he is, then he deserves your absolute, unqualified, unmitigated allegiance. Amen.